Chapter 6. The Human Mind. Now that we've covered the essentials of how businesses work, we're going to shift gears into understanding how people work. Businesses are built by people, for people. As we discussed in value creation and value delivery, if people didn't have needs and wants, businesses wouldn't exist. Likewise, if no one was able or willing to fulfill those needs and wants, businesses couldn't operate. Understanding how we take in information, how we make decisions, and how we decide what to do or what not to do is critically important if you want to create and sustain a successful business venture. Once you have a clear picture of how the human mind works, it's easy to find better ways to get things done and work more effectively with others. Caveman Syndrome. Imagine for a moment what it would be like to have lived 100,000 years ago. Your senses are on full alert as you walk along the banks of a river, scanning for food, fish swimming in the stream, edible plants, or animals to catch. The sun is nearing its apex, and you've already walked 6 miles today. Your calloused feet will take you 6 miles more before the day is done. In a few hours, you'll stop for some water and find shade. The mid-afternoon sun is blazingly hot, and rest will help you conserve energy. As you walk, your eyes settle on a small bush about 20 feet away. Your heart leaps, you recognize the pattern of the leaves, and you know that both the leaves and the roots are good to eat. You start to dig at the earth around the base of the plant to expose the roots, intending to place the entire shrub into the simple woven basket you have strapped to your back. Suddenly, you notice a movement out of the corner of your eye. 4 feet away, a massive cobra has drawn itself up to strike, displaying its distinctive patterned hood and sharp fangs. There's no time to think. Adrenaline surges, your pulse races, and you quickly jump up and run away as fast as you're able, leaving the food behind. You run until it's clear the threat is gone, and then you spend a few minutes recovering, trembling from the exertion and the stress as the adrenaline wears off. You're disappointed about losing the food, but it wasn't worth risking your life. Once you recover, you again search for food and shelter from the midday sun. Tonight, you'll return to your tribe to share what food you found. You know everyone well, since there are only 40 or so people in the tight-knit group. You've banded together primarily for protection from wild animals and other tribes, who periodically attempt to seize your tribe's resources via raids. Together, you make spears and nets to catch fish, turn flint into knives and axes for hunting and defense, and create baskets and clay pots to store food. On the fire, an antelope is roasting. A group of hunters in your tribe literally chased it to death, a technique called persistence hunting. In the evening, you'll sit around the fire the group has built to cook food and keep predators away, and you'll discuss the day and tell stories until you drift off to sleep. Tomorrow, you'll do it all over again. Human biology is optimized for conditions that existed 100,000 years ago, not for the world in which we actually live today. Food is everywhere. Predators are not. You no longer have to be in constant motion. Instead, you probably spend most of your time occupied by sedentary activities, like sitting behind a desk at a computer. As a result, we face many new threats to our brains and bodies, like obesity, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, and chronically low energy. Your brain and body simply aren't optimized for the modern world. Part of the challenge of working in the modern world is that our brains and bodies are tuned for physical and social survival, not 16-hour workdays. Business hasn't been around long enough for our biology to adapt to the new demands we're placing on ourselves. Don't be too hard on yourself. You simply weren't built for the type of work you're currently responsible for. No one is. We're all running demanding new software on ancient hardware. Performance requirements. Pounding Red Bull and pulling all-nighters can only take you so far. If you want to do good work, taking care of yourself isn't optional. If you don't give your body what it needs to run, you'll run out of gas long before you reach your goals. Your mind is first and foremost a physical system. Oftentimes, what we experience as mental fatigue or emotional distress is simply a signal from our body that we're not getting enough of something we physically need, nutrients, exercise, or rest. If you want to get things done, you can't run on empty. The human body has performance requirements. Just as a car can't run with an empty gas tank or a broken spark plug, your body can't operate for long without a few necessary inputs. When you have a lot of work to do, it's common to think that taking care of yourself is a secondary concern. It's not. Taking care of yourself should be your primary concern if you want to get important things done without burning out. Nutrition, exercise, and rest are the inputs your body converts into productive energy. Poor or too little input inevitably reduces the quantity and quality of your output. Here are a few basic guidelines to help you get the most out of each day. Eat high-quality food. Garbage in, garbage out. Pay attention to what you put into your body. If you eat meat, eggs, or dairy, avoid sources that contain antibiotics or hormones. Also, avoid refined sugar and processed foods as much as possible. If your great-grandparents wouldn't immediately recognize it as food, don't eat it. Eating a small snack or meal every 2.5 hours or so helps keep your blood sugar stable, so you don't crash during the day. I'm the kind of guy who sometimes forgets to eat, so I try to keep things simple. A handful of almonds or a piece of fruit works best for me. Use caffeine in moderation. Herbal tea is a good substitute for soda, and carrying a water bottle makes it much easier to stay hydrated. Exercise regularly. According to the book Brain Rules by John Medina, even low-intensity physical activity increases energy, improves mental performance, and enhances your ability to focus. Going for a walk or run, jumping rope, or doing a bit of yoga can help clear the cobwebs in your mind and give you more energy for the rest of the day. I often swing around a 14-pound sledgehammer to get my blood pumping. It's a cheap and effective weightlifting tool that doesn't take up much space. Just don't hit anything. Get at least 7 to 8 hours of sleep each night. Sleep helps consolidate the results of pattern matching and mental simulation, as well as reverse the effects of willpower depletion, all ideas we'll discuss later. So don't skimp on rest. I find it useful to set an alarm to remind me to go to bed, giving me enough time to wind down before retiring for the night. Going to bed early helps you get up early, which is very useful if you do creative work. I find it's best to write or do other creative tasks before the day begins, so you don't get distracted and run out of time. Get enough sun, but not too much. Vitamin D is an important part of many chemical reactions in your body, and your body can only create it if your skin is exposed to direct, non-filtered sunlight. Light through windows doesn't count. Just don't get too much. Sunburns and skin cancer aren't fun. Light helps set your circadian rhythm, which affects your sleeping patterns. I regularly use a light therapy device to ensure that I'm getting enough light, particularly in the winter months. Getting as little as 10 minutes of sunlight in the morning is a very easy way to improve both your sleep and your mood. Feed your brain the raw materials it needs to run. If you've ever felt angry, sad, apathetic, or lethargic for no reason, your body may not be getting enough of the raw materials necessary to build the neurotransmitters responsible for making you feel good. In the book The Mood Cure, Julia Ross explains that your brain needs certain compounds to produce critical mood-altering neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin. Without the materials necessary to build these mood-altering chemicals, you'll feel off, even if everything in your world is going just fine. Modern dietary changes make it necessary to get some of these substances in supplement form. A good multivitamin supplement, fish oil, magnesium, and essential amino acids can go a long way to ensure your brain has what it needs to function effectively. Just make sure that whatever you buy is highly bioavailable. Supplements won't help you if they pass through your body undigested. I constantly experiment with new ways to improve my energy, productivity, and mood, and I recommend you do the same. Guiding structure can help make these lifestyle changes much easier. Changing the structure of my environment has helped me make many changes almost effortlessly, including 3 years on a vegan diet, which is no animal products. Don't be afraid to try something new to see if you notice an improvement. Just be safe. When in doubt, consider how your ancient ancestors lived and act accordingly. The Onion Brain. Most of us identify with the voice inside our head that's constantly commenting about the world around us. That voice is sometimes electric with excitement, but more often it's uncertain, concerned, or scared. Fortunately, you are not that voice. You are only a small part of your brain. The voice in your head is just a radio announcer, commenting on what your brain is doing automatically. It is not you. Your consciousness is actually what your brain uses to solve problems it can't handle on autopilot. Since human behavior has its roots in the brain, it's very useful to understand how your brain is actually constructed. Here's a brief and massively oversimplified look at how your brain works. Think of the brain as an onion. It has several layers which sit on top of each other. At the core is a structure called the hindbrain, which is essentially responsible for keeping you alive. The hindbrain is responsible for all of the physiological functions necessary for survival: heart rate, sleeping, waking, reflexes, muscle movements, and biological urges. Located at the base of the brain, the hindbrain is sometimes called the lizard brain because this basic neurological structure appears in all of our biological precursors, including reptiles and amphibians. The hindbrain is primarily responsible for generating signals that are passed down through your spinal cord and nerves to every part of your body, resulting in your physical actions. Above your hindbrain is the midbrain, which is responsible for processing sensory data, emotion, memory, and pattern matching, which we'll discuss later. Our midbrains are constantly and automatically predicting what will happen next, then sending that information to the hindbrain, which readies our body for immediate action. The midbrain is the radio announcer, and the hindbrain is the radio. Sitting just above the midbrain is a thin, folded layer of tissue, the forebrain. This small sheet of brain matter is responsible for the cognitive capabilities that make us distinctly human: self-awareness, logic, deliberation, inhibition, and decision. Developmentally speaking, the forebrain is very new and likely evolved to help us handle ambiguity. Most of the time, our midbrain and hindbrain run the show. We're operating on instinct and autopilot. That changes, however, when we face something unexpected or unfamiliar, which confounds the midbrain's ability to predict what will happen next. That's when the forebrain kicks into gear, gathering data and considering options. After some deliberation and analysis, the forebrain decides what to do based on what appears to be best at the time. Once a decision is made, the midbrain and hindbrain assume normal operation and carry out the decision. Neuroscientists are probably ready to shoot me at this point, but this very basic model of the brain is accurate enough to be useful. PJ Eby, my mind-hacking friend and mentor, uses a great analogy to explain the relationship between the different parts of your mind. Your brain is a horse, and you are the rider. Your horse is intelligent. It moves on its own, can identify challenges, and will balk at things that appear dangerous or scary. You, the rider, are there to set a direction and reassure the horse that it's safe to proceed. One of the best things you can do to get more done is to dissociate yourself from the voice in your head. The radio announcer has the attention span of a 2-year-old after drinking a triple espresso. Its job is to highlight things in your environment you may be interested in paying attention to, things that may fulfill one of the core human drives or present some danger. That doesn't mean the voice is always right, or that you must take everything it says as gospel truth. Meditation is a simple practice that can help you separate you from the voice in your head. There's nothing mystical or magical about meditation. You simply breathe and watch what your monkey mind does without associating yourself with it. After a while, the voice becomes quieter, improving your ability to keep yourself on the course you choose. A few moments of quiet meditation every day can be the difference between feeling scared and overwhelmed and feeling in control of your destiny. If you're interested in learning to meditate, I recommend the book Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Perceptual Control. In businesses and business schools around the world, B.F. Skinner is the hidden king. Skinner was one of the major intellectual forces behind the behaviorist movement in psychology, the idea that biological systems always respond a certain way to certain stimuli. Control the stimuli, and you can control the behavior. Condition the organism with rewards and punishments, and the organism will learn exactly how to behave. Over the decades, behaviorism has fallen out of vogue in psychology. Research has made it clear that there's far more to behavior than the carrot and the stick. Unfortunately, that hasn't extended to business practice. In corporations and business school classrooms around the world, the search continues for the magic incentive that will make people do exactly what businesses want. In reality, human behavior is much more like a thermostat. A thermostat is a very simple system. All it consists of is a sensor, a set point, and a switch. The sensor measures the temperature of the surrounding environment. When the temperature is within a given range, the thermostat does nothing. When the temperature is below the set point, the switch turns the heater on. Once the temperature is above the set point, the switch turns the heater off. This relationship is called perceptual control, The thermostat controls the temperature of the room by comparing the perceived temperature against the set point, then taking an action if and only if that perception is out of control. Once the action brings the perception under control, the system stops acting until the set point is violated once again. Living organisms, including human beings, are essentially very complex perceptual control systems. We act in ways to keep our perceptions of the world within acceptable boundaries. We don't put on a coat because the cold weather forces us to. We put on a coat because we feel cold and we don't want to feel cold. If the light entering our eyes is too bright, we find shade, pull down the blinds on the windows, or put on sunglasses. The action controls the perception, and the action we ultimately take depends on the environment we find ourselves in at the time. In the book Making Sense of Behavior, The Meaning of Control, William T. Powers uses the following example to explain how control systems account for the wide range of behaviors human beings exhibit. Imagine a ship in the middle of an ocean during a wild storm. The ship is rising and falling randomly, pitching back and forth as it's buffeted by the waves. A rock on the deck of the ship is not a control system. The rock doesn't want anything, so it has nothing to control. It just tumbles wherever the forces of physics take it. A human being on the ship, however, wants to stay upright, and will therefore take many different actions to continue to stay standing, changing balance, moving, holding onto handrails, etc. If the human stumbles and falls, they'll take whatever actions they can to get back on their feet once more. The environment dictates which actions are possible to bring the perception under control. Control is not planning. It's adjusting to changes in the environment as they actually happen. The human in the storm doesn't have the ability to predetermine what actions they'll take to stay on their feet. As the environment changes, their actions will change in response, depending on the resources and options available at the moment. Perceptual control explains why the same stimulus often produces different responses. A good example of why the stimulus-response model doesn't paint the whole picture is the classic incentive of many employers, paid overtime. If you want your hourly employees to work more, you should pay them more overtime, right? Not necessarily. Workers who are controlling for income, that is, they don't have enough income and they want more, will probably work more overtime. But what about workers who feel they're making enough money or have priorities that are more important than work? A few of those workers will work exactly the same amount of time, and some will actually work less. They're controlling for a certain amount of income, then spending their time doing other things that are important to them, like being with their family or pursuing a side project. Raising overtime pay will allow them to reach that point more quickly, so they'll spend less time at work. The overtime incentive produces three different results, two of which are complete opposites, working more and working less. So much for behaviorism. Perceptual control represents a fundamental shift in understanding why people do the things they do. Once you understand that people act to control their perceptions, you'll be better equipped to influence how they act. Reference level. At the heart of every perceptual control system is a reference level, a range of perceptions that indicate the system is under control. When a perception is within the system's reference level, nothing happens. When the perception violates the reference level by being too high or too low, the system will act to bring the perception back under control. There are three kinds of reference levels: set points, ranges, and errors. A set point is a minimum or maximum value. The thermostat is an example of a set point. Whenever the temperature falls below a certain value, the heater kicks on. Your body's production of melatonin is another set point. Once it reaches a particular threshold, you'll start falling asleep. Business financial controls are managed as set points. As long as your revenue is above a certain set point and your expenses are below a certain set point, you're okay. If you suddenly spend three times what you normally spend or your revenue falls below your point of sufficiency, that triggers action. You want to find out why you overspent and how to bring your expenses back under control. A range is a spread of acceptable values. The difference between a range and a set point is the existence of an upper and a lower limit to the perception being controlled. With a set point, the perception must be above or below a certain level to be under control. With a range, the perception must be between two set points to be under control. For example, your body has a system for regulating the level of glucose in your blood, which it uses for energy. Too much or too little blood glucose can be life-threatening, so your body works to keep the level within an acceptable range by releasing insulin, which causes extra glucose to move into or out of the cells in your body. As long as your blood glucose is within the acceptable range, nothing happens. When the reference range is violated, your body starts working to bring the situation back under control. An error is a set point defined as zero. Any perception that's not zero is out of control. Think of the pain receptors in your skin. Most of the time, they do nothing, which means everything is under control. If you cut or burn yourself, however, the receptors send a signal that something is wrong, and you'll act to remedy the situation. Customer service complaints are a business example. If you don't receive any, everything is under control. If your inbox is filling with complaints, you know that something needs to be fixed. If you want to change a behavior, you must either change the system's reference level or change the environment in which the system is operating. Think back to the thermostat. If you want to turn the heater off, you can change the set point to a lower temperature. If you're aware that your expenses will be three times what they were in the last month because you're launching a huge marketing campaign, your finances are no longer out of control. If you're in the process of getting a tattoo, pain receptors firing is an acceptable situation. The perceptions themselves haven't changed, but you'll no longer act to bring the perception under control because it already is under control. Changing the reference level changes the behavior of the system. Consciously defining and redefining reference levels can help you change your behavior. If you're worried that your spending is out of control, you can create a budget that will give you information on what your target monthly revenue needs to be in order to stay sufficient. If you're worried that your weight is too high or low, a visit to your doctor can help you calibrate your expectations and self-perception against medical data. If you're consistently working 12-hour days and you decide that no more than 8 is acceptable, your work habits will change. Change the reference level, and your behavior will change automatically. Conservation of energy. Here's a universal truth of human nature. People are generally lazy. The critical insight is that being lazy is a feature, not a bug. Think of what would happen if one of your ancient ancestors ran around all day for no good reason until they collapsed from exhaustion. If a predator or enemy appeared, they'd have no reserves left to respond to the threat. A very bad situation. As a result, we've evolved to avoid expending energy unless absolutely necessary, which I call conservation of energy. Over the past several decades, researchers have studied marathoners and ultramarathoners, people who regularly run 50 to 100 miles at a stretch, to learn more about how the body responds to pain. Here's what they found. When you're so tired that it feels like you're about to kick the bucket any second, physiologically, you're not even remotely close to actually dying. The signals your brain is sending to your body are a ruse that serves as a warning, prompting you to keep some energy in reserve just in case energy is needed later. Unless a reference level is violated, people will generally conserve energy by not acting. Think of two roommates who share different standards of household cleanliness. To one, the presence of dirty dishes in the sink is a problem. In his mind, any dishes at all is out of control, which prompts action to fix the situation. To the other roommate, the situation may not be out of control until the sink is overflowing, at which point he'll expend some energy washing dishes. Different reference levels, different actions. If you think your weight, health, and physique are just fine, you probably won't change your diet or start exercising spontaneously. If you're comfortable with your social circle and confidence, you probably won't do much to improve your social skills or expand your circle of acquaintances. If you think you're making enough money, you probably won't do much to earn more. Conservation of energy explains why some people stay in dead-end jobs for decades, even though they know the position isn't great. If the work is okay, the bills get paid, and the job never becomes stressful or frustrating enough to violate expectations, people generally won't go out of their way to get a promotion, find another job, or start a new business. People only start to expend effort if their reference levels are violated in some way, So if their expectations aren't violated, they simply don't act. Sources of information that change your reference levels are valuable in prompting action. One of the things that prompted me to build courses and offer consulting was the knowledge that some business authors and coaches were able to spend all day learning and helping others and be paid very well for their expertise. That was enough to violate my reference levels about work at the time. If they could get paid for doing what I loved to do, why should I have to spend all day in a day job that was just okay? The more I learned about what people did to make this possible, the more I wanted to do to make it a reality for myself. Before Roger Bannister's record-breaking performance in 1954, running a mile in under 4 minutes was considered beyond the physical limitations of the human body. After Bannister proved it was possible, the psychological barrier was broken. By the end of 1957, 16 runners had accomplished the feat. The only thing that changed was the reference level. These athletes knew it was possible and wanted to do it, so they did. Good books, magazines, blogs, documentaries, and even competitors are valuable if they violate your expectations about what's possible. When you discover that other people are actually doing something you previously considered unrealistic or impossible, it changes your reference levels in a very useful way. All you need to know is that something you want is possible, and you'll find a way to get it. Guiding structure. For 3 years, Kelsey and I experimented with a vegan diet. No animal products whatsoever. No meat, no eggs, no cheese, no milk. Most of our friends and family had two responses. Are you crazy? And that must be very difficult. I could never do that. It was such a drastic lifestyle change that people marveled at our willpower. I'd like to make a confession. It wasn't difficult at all. There was very little effort or willpower involved. Here's the secret. Instead of relying on willpower to resist the urge to cook a steak or order a pepperoni pizza, we changed the structure of our environment to support our choices. We threw out all of the food we didn't want to eat and replaced it with healthier options that still tasted good. We changed where we shopped. Instead of going to the supermarket, we went to a small natural food store. We stopped going to steakhouses and started going to restaurants that specialized in serving vegetarian and vegan food. As a result, we didn't have to use much willpower to act consistently with our choice. When I got hungry, I ate an apple or carrots and hummus. That's what was in the refrigerator. Ordering a pizza or buying and cooking a steak took more effort, so I didn't do it. By changing the structure of our environment, Kelsey and I made it easier to act the way we had decided to act. Guiding structure means changing the structure of your environment is the largest determinant of your behavior. If you want to successfully change a behavior, don't try to change the behavior directly. Change the structure that influences or supports the behavior, and the behavior will change automatically. If you don't want to eat ice cream, don't buy it in the first place. In Homer's Odyssey, Odysseus and his crew prepare to sail past the island of the Sirens, bird women who sang so beautifully that unwitting sailors would lose all reason and shipwreck themselves. Instead of relying on strength of will to resist the temptation of the sirens, Odysseus changed the structure of the environment, plugging his men's ears with beeswax and tying himself to the ship's mast. Temptation thus avoided, the ship made safe passage. Change the structure of your environment, and your behavior will change automatically. Add a bit of friction or eliminate certain options completely, and you'll find it much easier to focus on what you're trying to accomplish. A great example of guiding structure is the sterile cockpit rule that the Federal Aviation Administration instituted in 1981. Most airline accidents happen below 10,000 feet, where distractions can be deadly. Above 10,000 feet, pilots can talk about anything they want, but below 10,000 feet, the only discussion permitted is about information directly related to the flight in progress. By eliminating distractions, the sterile cockpit rule reduces errors and accidents. Change the structure of your environment, and you'll be amazed at how drastically your behavior will change in response. Reorganization. Whenever a perception violates the system's reference level, action will occur to bring the perception back under control. Sometimes that response is well-defined. As we discussed earlier, your body knows exactly what it needs to do to regulate blood glucose. Often, however, you don't know exactly what is wrong or how to fix it. Think of a perception as abstract as job satisfaction. There's a set point in your mind that stands for how happy I should be at work, and your perception of job satisfaction is an average of your actual experiences at work. Pleasant experiences move the average higher, and unpleasant experiences move the average lower. If your perception of job satisfaction is lower than you think it should be, your reference level, your brain will kick into action. I'm not as happy as I should be. Something needs to change. Here's the problem. You may not know what that something is. Would you be happier if you changed assignments, worked for a new boss, left the company, or started working for yourself? Who knows? That's where reorganization comes in. Reorganization is random action that occurs when a reference level is violated, but you don't know what to do to bring the perception back under control. The quarter-life or midlife crisis many people experience is a perfect example of reorganization. You don't quite know what to do to eliminate the angst you're feeling, so you start doing things that aren't normal for you, like quitting your job to backpack across Europe or getting a tattoo and buying a motorcycle. Reorganization feels like you're lost, depressed, or crazy. That's completely normal. Your brain starts spitting out all kinds of off-the-wall things in an effort to find something to fix the situation. Sometimes, when I'm really stressed out, I'll start to think that being a janitor sounds very appealing. The work's not difficult, you don't have to think so much, and you still get paid. That doesn't mean it's a good idea, but this type of thought process is absolutely normal. My brain is just trying out random ideas to bring certain systems back under control. Reorganization is the neurological basis of learning. As we'll discuss in pattern matching, our minds are learning machines that associate specific causes with specific effects. If your mind hasn't already learned what to do in a certain situation, the best way to solve the problem is to try new things in an effort to gather data. That's what reorganization is for. It's the impulse to consider or try new things to see what works. One of the most important things to understand about reorganization is that it's best not to fight it. Even though it's sometimes tempting to try to convince yourself that everything is okay, resisting or repressing the impulse to try something different slows down your learning. There's nothing odd or abnormal about dark nights of the soul. They're a signal that some perception about your life is out of control, and reorganization is required to gather more data about how to fix it. Once you learn how to bring the perception back under control, reorganization stops naturally. When you're feeling lost, take heart. It's just your brain gathering information it needs to make good decisions. Embracing the impulse to try something new will help you exit reorganization more quickly. Conflict. Let's take a moment to examine everyone's favorite character flaw, procrastination. Everyone procrastinates to a certain extent. With too many things to do, putting off tasks until they feel urgent is a natural response. How can you focus on something due in the future when there's something that needs to be done now? What's particularly frustrating are the times we know we have time to get something done in advance, but we just don't feel like doing it right now. Part of us wants to work, and part of us wants to not work. If you try to force yourself to work, you find that you're so easily distracted that not much gets done. If you try to rest, part of you feels bad that you're not working, which means you're not really resting. Entire days can pass where you neither really work nor really rest, but you feel exhausted from the effort of getting nothing done. What gives? Conflicts occur when two control systems try to change the same perception. When you're procrastinating, one of your brain subsystems is trying to control getting things done, while another is trying to control getting enough rest. Since both systems are trying to control the same perception, physical action, the systems fight to move the perception in the way they want it to go. The situation is like a heater and an air conditioner fighting to control the temperature in a single room. As long as their respective reference levels are mutually exclusive, neither system will ever be under control. They'll continue to expend effort to move the system in the direction they're controlling for. Even if one system brings their perception back under control temporarily, it won't be long before the other system ensures it's out of control once more. Procrastination is an example of an inner conflict, but conflicts happen between people as well. Conflicts occur when people are controlling for different outputs that require the same input. Think of two children fighting over the same toy. It's the procrastination and temperature battle all over again, only the control systems are people. As long as one child has the toy, the other will be upset. As a result, the toy moves back and forth constantly, and both children are upset. Think about senior leaders in a large company squabbling over how a limited budget will be allocated, and you'll have a good idea of where conflicts come from. If $1 million is allocated to one vice president, that means all of the other vice presidents can't use it, so they protest. Corporate politics at its finest. One of the things that make interpersonal conflict challenging is that we can never truly control the actions of another human being. We can influence, persuade, inspire, or negotiate, but we can never directly act upon another person's perceptions or directly change their reference levels. Conflicts can only be resolved by changing reference levels, how success is defined by the parties involved. Attempting to resolve a conflict by simply calling attention to unacceptable behavior is ineffective in the same way that willpower can't change behavior directly. It's not addressing the root cause of the conflict. Each party in the conflict has a different reference level, which is primarily influenced by the situation or the environment. The only way to resolve the conflict is to change each party's reference level, which is best done by changing the structure of the situation. In the case of procrastination, conflict can be ended by scheduling firm times for work and rest, ensuring enough of each. In the book The Now Habit, Neil Fiore recommends creating what he calls an unschedule that prioritizes rest over work. When your brain is sure that you'll be receiving all of the relaxation and enjoyment you need, and that you only have a certain amount of time to get things done, it's easier to focus on doing productive work. In the case of the competing heater and air conditioner, the situation can only exist as long as you maintain the conflicting temperatures on the thermostats. Change the reference levels, and you resolve the conflict. In the case of squabbling children, or vice presidents, you can change the situation by ensuring that each combatant gets roughly the same toy, gets no toy at all, or changes their measure of success from getting mine to working together. Change the situation that creates the reference levels each party is using to measure success, and you'll eliminate the conflict. Pattern matching. Long before you knew what gravity was, you knew that a ball would move toward the ground if you released it. The first few times you let go of a ball, it would always fall to the ground. It didn't take many such experiences for you to learn that any object you released would fall. Gravity is just a name for something your brain learned by itself. One of the most interesting things about the brain is its ability to automatically learn and recognize patterns. Think of Ivan Pavlov's famous dogs. Ring a bell, and they'll start to salivate. Pavlov taught them a pattern. Every time the bell rings, food is on the way. It didn't take long for the dogs to learn the pattern, so they'd respond even before the food appeared. Our brains are natural pattern-matching machines. The brain is constantly busy trying to find patterns in what we perceive, then associating new patterns with other patterns that are stored in memory. This pattern-matching process happens automatically, without conscious effort. Simply by paying attention to the world around you, your brain is collecting new patterns and adding them to memory. Humans learn patterns primarily via experimentation. If a small child wants to be held by its mother, it doesn't take long to try several different approaches and learn which response produces the desired result. Typically, if I cry, mom is going to pick me up and hold me. From then on, the child will rely on the pattern whenever it desires the result. You can think of your memory as the database of patterns you've learned via past experience. Patterns get stored in our long-term memory, waiting to be used to determine responses to new or uncommon situations. Recall is optimized for speed, not accuracy. The brain stores information contextually, which helps you recall related patterns quickly when you need them. That's why the best way to find a set of lost keys is to mentally walk through all of the places you've been recently. The context makes it easier to recall the information. The more accurate patterns you've learned, the more options you have when solving new problems. Pattern matching is one of the primary reasons experienced people tend to make better decisions than inexperienced people. They've learned more accurate patterns via their experience. Having a larger mental database to draw from is what gives experts their expertise. Pattern matching is one of the foundational capabilities of our mind and how it works. The more accurate patterns you have stored in your memory, the more quickly and accurately you can respond to whatever life throws at you. Mental simulation. Quick, imagine jumping into the middle of an active volcano. Is it a good idea? Answering this question took you only a few fractions of a second, even though you've never personally jumped into a volcano or seen anyone who has. What you've done is quite extraordinary. How is it possible to immediately know the answer to something you've never considered before? Mental simulation is our mind's ability to imagine taking a specific action, then simulating the probable result before acting. Our minds are constantly trying to predict what will happen in the future based on what's happening around us and what actions we're considering. Anticipating the results of our actions is a significant advantage. It dramatically enhances our ability to solve novel problems. Mental simulation relies on our memory, the database of patterns we've learned via perception and experience. When you imagined jumping into a volcano, your brain couldn't find any personal experiences, but it did find relevant associations. Lava is hot, hot things burn, burns are painful and dangerous things are bad. This set of associations is used to simulate the probable result in the blink of an eye, resulting in a snap judgment. Very bad idea. Mental simulation is extremely powerful and versatile. It can be used to test even the most arbitrary actions without risk. Given any goal or scenario, mental simulation is what your brain uses to connect point A to point B, where point A is where you are now, and point B is what you're imagining. The only limit on what you can simulate is your imagination. For example, how would you go about visiting Antarctica? It's a random question, but by holding the desired end result in your mind for a few seconds, your brain automatically starts connecting the dots based on the patterns you've learned. I could call a travel agent. Cruises go to Antarctica all the time. I'd have to fly to Argentina, and I'd have to buy a really warm coat, etc. All of this thinking just happens without much effort on your part. It's what your brain is designed to do. Mental simulation only works if you supply a point B, even if the action or goal is completely arbitrary. You can simulate the path to even the most unrealistic and absurd destination you can imagine. Think of using a service like Google Maps or a vehicle GPS system. The system can give you accurate directions, but it won't work unless you enter a destination. That destination can be your best friend's house or someplace random like Albuquerque, New Mexico. Either way, without supplying a goal, the system can't operate. The same rule applies to mental simulation. No destination, no simulation. Mental simulation is particularly powerful if you learn how to harness it consciously, which we'll explore in detail later in counterfactual simulation. Interpretation and reinterpretation. Have you ever received an email from someone that made you very angry, only to find out later that you misunderstood the tone or intent of the message? Your mind reached a conclusion that wasn't true based on what you thought you perceived, only to discover there was a different way of interpreting the message that also made sense. Our minds are always simulating different courses of action, but sometimes there's not enough information to ensure that a pattern is completely accurate. Since you're not omniscient, your mind never has complete data, so it automatically fills in missing pieces by interpreting what you sense via the patterns you have stored in memory. In the absence of any other information to the contrary, you'll jump to conclusions by relying on the interpretation your mind creates. This capacity to fill in the blanks even happens on the physiological level. In our field of vision, we have two complete blind spots, the points where our optic nerves connect to our eyes. We literally cannot see in those spots, but our brains automatically take in all of the surrounding information and seamlessly fill in the blanks. As a result, we appear to have a solid field of vision, even though it's an illusion created by our brain's ability to interpret information. The human brain constantly relies on prior patterns and information to make interpretations in the absence of information. Think of the spam folder in your email account. It uses a collection of previous spam messages, called priors, to estimate the probability that any new incoming message is also spam, using a process called Bayesian inference. The messages don't self-identify as spam, but the computer's Bayesian spam filter can spot them anyway. Your brain does roughly the same thing every time you decide you like someone right after meeting them. Your brain is relying on patterns you've learned via past experiences with other people to make a snap judgment. These snap interpretations can also be altered, a process called reinterpretation. Think of meeting an attractive person who consistently becomes quiet and aloof when you're around. At first glance, their behavior may signal that they're shy or they don't like you very much. If one of your friends tells you that they're romantically interested in you, however, your interpretation of that person's past behavior can change in an instant. Reinterpretation is possible because your memory is fundamentally impermanent. Our memories aren't like computer disks. Every time we recall a memory, it doesn't simply resave to the same location in the same state. Every time we recall something, the memory is saved in a different location with a twist. The new memory will include any alterations we've made to it. It's possible to change your beliefs and mental simulations consciously by recalling and actively reinterpreting past events. Mental simulation and interpretation rely on patterns stored in memory, so if you want to change the results of your brain's simulations, the best way to go about doing that is to alter the mental database of information those simulations are based on. Reinterpretation is how you change the database. In the book Recreate Your Life, Morty Lefko teaches a process that can be used to reinterpret past events in a simple and useful way. Number one, identify the undesirable pattern. Number two, name the underlying belief. Number three, identify the source of the belief in memory, including as much sensory detail as possible. Number four, describe possible alternate interpretations of the memory. Number five, realize that your original belief is an interpretation, not reality. Number six, consciously choose to reject the original belief as false. And number seven, consciously choose to accept your reinterpretation as true. Here's an example of how I personally used Lefko's process. One possible way of interpreting my brand management career at P&G is that I was a miserable failure. I was on the management fast track, and I couldn't cut it, so I washed out. For a while, I believed that was true, but that belief didn't serve me very well. When I tried to explore alternate paths, my mind naturally simulated that my quote-unquote failure would extend to my new projects as well. As long as my mind relied on this interpretation to simulate the future, I was stuck in a self-defeating cycle. There's another way of interpreting my previous career at P&G. My experience taught me a lot about how large corporations work, and I learned more about what I'm good at, what I don't particularly enjoy doing, and how I want to invest my time. Working at P&G helped me discover a path that didn't work for me, so I stopped following that path and tried other things that better fit my strengths and desires until I found one I loved, a major victory and a huge life improvement. Which interpretation is true? Both are valid interpretations. My mind wasn't malfunctioning when it created the first interpretation, but that interpretation didn't serve me very well. Reinterpreting the situation and accepting the second version as true was much more useful. Without it, you probably wouldn't be listening to this book. Reinterpret your past, and you'll enhance your ability to make great things happen in the present. Motivation. Motivation is something that you probably think about all the time, using phrases like, I'm feeling really motivated to get this done, or I'm not feeling very motivated to do this right now. Since so many of us rely on this term to explain our daily experience, it's worthwhile to understand what we're actually talking about. Motivation is an emotional state that links the parts of our brain that feel with the parts that are responsible for action. Using the onion brain as a basic model, motivation is the link between the midbrain, which perceives the world, and the hindbrain, which sends the signals to our body to take action. In most cases, motivation is automatic. Our mind perceives a difference between the way things are and the way we want them to be, and the body automatically acts to eliminate the difference. You can break down the experience of motivation into two basic desires: moving toward things that are desirable and moving away from things that aren't. Things that fulfill our core human drives appear desirable, so we experience an impulse to move toward them. Things that appear dangerous, scary, or threatening are undesirable, so we naturally experience an impulse to move away from them. In general, moving away takes priority over moving toward. The reason comes back to caveman syndrome. Running away from a lion automatically takes priority over cooking lunch. Let's say you have an exciting opportunity to start a new business. A feeling of excitement may cause you to move toward that opportunity. At the same time, if the opportunity requires you to leave a high-paying job, which feels risky, you may be compelled to move away from the very same opportunity, resulting in conflict. As long as the risk outweighs the excitement, you'll hesitate, even if there's very little chance you'll ever be in danger if you take the leap. This safety mechanism in our minds developed for very good reasons, but today, most of the decisions we make don't have life and death consequences. Motivation is an emotion, not a logical, rational activity. Just because your forebrain thinks you should be motivated to do something does not mean you'll automatically become motivated to do that thing. If only it were that easy, right? Very often, mental simulations, patterns, conflicts, and interpretations hidden in the midbrain can get in the way of making progress toward what we want to accomplish. As long as there are move away from signals being sent, you'll have a hard time feeling motivated to move toward what you want. In the same vein, you can't motivate other people by yelling at them to work faster. All the drill sergeant approach accomplishes is making them want to move away from you. They may comply with you temporarily if they perceive some threat to themselves if they don't, but you can bet that they'll move away from working with you at the first available opportunity. Eliminate the inner conflicts that compel you to move away from potential threats, and you'll find yourself experiencing a feeling of motivation to move toward what you really want. Inhibition. Believe it or not, most of your daily actions require very little conscious thought. Most of the time, our bodies and minds are on autopilot. Our minds sense the world around us, compare our environment and actions against internal reference levels, and act accordingly. Think about driving a car. With practice, your body does everything necessary to keep the car on the road without requiring much conscious thought. Every once in a while, it pays to ignore the autopilot and do something different. If you stumble across a bear in the woods, the last thing you want to do is run, even though that's what your instincts may be telling you to do. If you run, the bear is likely to decide you look like lunch and chase you down. Instead of running, it's actually more effective to stand your ground and make yourself appear as big and loud and threatening as you can. Appearing to be a threat requires you to consciously inhibit your natural response, but it'll cause the bear to see you as a threat and decide to leave you alone. Inhibition is the ability to temporarily override our natural inclinations. If you've ever put up with one of your siblings or colleagues acting immature, obnoxious, or annoying, inhibition prevented you from doing something you would have regretted later. Willpower is the fuel of inhibition. As we discussed in the section on the onion brain, the forebrain's job is ambiguity resolution, decision-making, and inhibition. Whenever we inhibit our natural responses to our environment, willpower is at work. Our midbrain and hindbrain are the autopilot, and the forebrain is the override. In that sense, free will is a bit misleading. Free won't is a more accurate description. Inhibiting certain decisions or responses can be beneficial, but our ability to inhibit has limitations, which we'll discuss next. Willpower depletion. In the 1960s, Dr. Walter Mischel, a researcher at Columbia University, systematically tortured small children. Here's how he did it. Dr. Mischel placed the child in a small room with a table and chair. In the middle of the table, Dr. Mischel would place a big, fluffy marshmallow, then tell the child, "If you wait until I come back, you can have two." Then he'd leave. Here's what happened. Some kids would gobble up the marshmallow seconds after the researcher left. Others made heroic efforts to distract themselves from temptation, forcing themselves to pay attention to something other than the marshmallow in an agonizing attempt to hold out long enough to get the bigger reward. Dr. Mischel found a correlation between willpower and success. Kids with a greater ability to defer gratification were more successful in school, as well as later on in life. Overriding our instincts can often make it possible to collect larger rewards later. Spending is easy, but saving is not, even if the latter is more beneficial over time. Willpower can be thought of as instinctual override. It's a way to interrupt our automatic processing in order to do something else. Whenever we experience a situation in which it's useful to inhibit our natural inclinations, willpower is required to keep us from responding. Accordingly, willpower is a useful tool, but it has certain inherent limitations. Our reserves of willpower are very limited and become depleted with use. Dr. Roy Baumeister, a researcher at Florida State University, found that our ability to successfully use willpower for self-control tasks is dependent on a physiological fuel, blood glucose. Acts of willpower deplete relatively large amounts of glucose, and when those stores run low, we have a hard time using willpower to inhibit behavior. That's why it's difficult to resist dishing up a bowl of ice cream at 8:30 p.m. when you're on a diet. By then, your stores of willpower are long gone. The best way to use your limited reserves of willpower is to use guiding structure to change the structure of your environment instead of your behavior. For example, if you decide you want to quit eating ice cream, it doesn't make sense to keep a tub in your freezer, then rely on your willpower to resist the temptation to eat it. That situation is a recipe for disappointment, and when your willpower inevitably fails, it's easy to misinterpret the lapse as a fundamental character flaw. Instead, it's much more effective to use a little willpower to remove the ice cream from your freezer entirely, either by giving it to someone else or throwing it away. By removing the ice cream from your environment, no willpower is required. You'd actually have to go somewhere to get it, which takes more effort. The path of least resistance changes accordingly, so if you're hungry, you'll eat something else, an apple perhaps. The internet is a massive temptation to me. I love learning new things, and the web contains enough interesting information to keep me endlessly occupied. It's easier for me to spend time reading rather than writing, but I write on a computer, which is the equivalent of keeping ice cream in my freezer. It's always there, tempting me away from writing. Instead of constantly relying on my willpower to finish this book, I used a small amount of willpower to alter my environment by installing an application called Freedom on my computer. The program temporarily disables the internet on my laptop, making it impossible for me to connect to the internet for a few hours. Temptation thus obliterated, I write. It's safe to say that, without freedom, you wouldn't be listening to this book right now. Save your willpower. Focus on using it to change your environment, and you'll have more available to use whenever inhibition is necessary. Loss aversion. Recently, my wife Kelsey decided to withdraw some funds from an investment account. When the brokerage deposited the money into her bank account, they deposited an additional $10,000 by mistake. Rationally, it shouldn't have been a big deal. It was a simple mistake that was easily corrected. Emotionally, however, Kelsey felt like she was losing the extra money, even though it wasn't really hers at all. Loss aversion is the idea that people hate to lose things more than they like to gain them. There are very few relationships that psychology is able to quantify, but this is one of them. People respond twice as strongly to potential loss as they do to the opportunity of an equivalent gain. If you look at your investment portfolio and you notice that it's increased by 100%, you'll feel pretty good. If you notice that your portfolio went down 100%, you'll feel horrible. Loss aversion explains why threats typically take precedence over opportunities when it comes to motivation. The threat of loss used to require immediate attention because losses were extremely costly, even life-threatening. Dying or losing a loved one to a predator, sickness, exposure, or starvation is universally a horrible experience, so we're built to do everything in our power to prevent that from happening. The potential losses we typically face now are rarely as serious, but our minds still give them automatic priority. Loss aversion also explains why uncertainty appears risky. Depending on the study you look at, anywhere between 80 and 90% of adults think that it would be great to own their own business and work for themselves. If that's true, why don't more people start businesses? Loss aversion keeps them from acting. The threat of losing a steady and somewhat predictable job commands more attention than the opportunity to create a new self-sustaining business. Starting a business involves the specter of potential loss, which prevents people from getting started in the first place. Loss aversion is particularly pronounced in recessions and depressions. Losing a job, a home, or a significant percentage of your retirement fund isn't life-threatening, but it feels horrible all the same. As a result, people tend to become more conservative, avoiding risks that could make things worse. Unfortunately, some of those risks, like starting a new business, may actually present a major opportunity to make things better. The best way to overcome loss aversion is to reinterpret the risk of loss as no big deal. Casinos are in the business of overcoming loss aversion every single day. In a sense, the ostentatious buildings on the Las Vegas Strip are enormous monuments to human stupidity. If loss aversion is such a big deal, how do casinos encourage people to play games in which they're mathematically certain to lose money? Casinos win by abstracting the loss. Instead of having players gamble with currency, which is perceived as valuable, the casino converts currency into chips or debit cards, which don't feel as valuable. As the player loses this fake money over time, the casino will provide rewards like free drinks, t-shirts, room upgrades, or other benefits to alleviate any remaining sense of loss. As a result, losing becomes no big deal, so players continue to play and continue to lose money night after night. Loss aversion is why risk reversal is so important if you're presenting an offer to a potential customer. People hate to lose, which makes them feel stupid and taken advantage of. As a result, they'll go to great lengths to ensure that they don't lose, and the best way to ensure that they don't make a stupid decision is not to buy your offer in the first place. If you're in the business of making sales, that's a big problem. Eliminate this perception of risk by offering a money-back guarantee or similar risk reversal offer, and people will feel the decision is less risky, resulting in more sales. Threat lockdown. You're fast asleep when something goes bump in the night. Almost immediately, you're alert. Your heart rate increases, your pupils dilate to take in more light and detail, and stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol flood your bloodstream. Your mind automatically identifies the likely source of the noise, escape routes, and potential defensive weapons. In the blink of an eye, you're ready to defend yourself against the threat, whatever it might be. When your mind perceives a potential threat, real or imaginary, your body immediately prepares to respond. This automatic physiological response is designed to help you do one of three things to eliminate the threat: fight, flee, or freeze. As long as you're in protection mode, it's difficult to do anything other than fixate on the threat. Until you search the house, there's no way you'll be able to go back to sleep. Your body will only come out of protective mode after you're certain there's no threat to face. The subconscious choice to fight, flee, or freeze is largely dependent on your brain's automatic mental simulation of the situation. If your brain predicts you can win if you fight, you'll fight. If your brain predicts you can win by getting away, you'll flee. If your brain predicts that you can't get away, you'll freeze in the hope that the threat will pass you by. Freezing makes your brain go into threat lockdown, protection mode, which makes it difficult to do anything other than fixate on the threat. Threat lockdown is a constructive response designed to help you defend yourself, but like many ancient instincts, it often malfunctions in our modern environment. The threats you face are far less acute today, but they are often chronic. In the olden days, when the threat was a predator or an angry tribal chief, the lockdown response was constructive since it focused our energy on staying alive and/or part of the tribe. Even though the thoughts that run through our heads on a daily basis have little in common with those of our ancient ancestors, the hardware those thoughts are running on, our brains, is still largely the same and is constantly on the lookout for very old threats in a very new environment. As a result, we eat too much and exercise too little, and the instinctive behaviors of fighting like hell, freezing, or running away aren't very constructive when dealing with an angry boss or an overdue mortgage payment. The recent turmoil in the stock market is an excellent example of threat lockdown in action. The stock market crash in late 2008 sparked a flurry of panic and hand-wringing, even among people who were in no danger of losing their homes or jobs. The mere possibility of bad things happening grinds businesses to a halt at the same time increased productivity is needed to keep the firm in good shape. Instead of focusing on doing good work, employees spend most of their time and energy worrying about what the future holds and gossiping about who's next on the chopping block, decreasing the overall amount of value created and increasing the likelihood that the firm's future will get worse. Threat lockdown can easily become a vicious cycle. If you're ever in the unfortunate situation of having to lay off workers, it's best to do it quickly, cleanly, and all at once. It's best to make the cut swiftly, then reassure remaining employees that no more cuts will be made. Rumors of layoffs or workers constantly wondering if I'll be next is a recipe for threat lockdown. If you're experiencing threat lockdown, don't try to repress the threat signal. Many studies have shown that active repression doesn't make a perception go away. Instead, it makes the signals progressively stronger. Think of what a small child does when they want to get your attention, but you ignore them. They'll continually increase the commotion they make until they're sure you've noticed them. Your brain does the same thing. Repression only makes the threat signals stronger. Consciously sending a mental message retrieved, safe to proceed signal to your brain is a simple and surprisingly effective way to make yourself stop fixating on the issue so you can consider appropriate responses. The key to dealing with threat lockdown is to convince your mind that the threat no longer exists. You can do that in one of two ways. Number one, you can convince your mind that there was never actually any threat. Or number two, you can convince your mind that the threat has passed. Convincing your mind that there was never a threat is the equivalent of searching your house in the dark at midnight. The search proves that no threats exist, so it's safe to leave protective mode. Convincing your mind that the threat has passed does the same thing. The threat is gone and can no longer harm you, so it's safe to carry on. Sometimes it's difficult to defuse threat lockdown, particularly if you've been in it for a long time. Because protective mode is physiological, it's often best to use physiological means to calm yourself down. Exercise, sleep, and meditation can calm your mind by metabolizing or counteracting the stress hormones that have been flooding your body. When you're feeling overwhelmed, going for a quick run or lifting weights can do wonders for your state of mind. Notice the threat signal, then do what you can to prove to your mind the threat no longer exists, and you'll break yourself out of threat lockdown. Cognitive scope limitation. If you ever have a chance to walk through the middle of Times Square in New York City during tourist season, you'll quickly realize that, to most of the people moving towards you, you are not a person. Instead of being a human being, you are an object, an obstacle standing between where they are and where they want to go. As a result, they'll run you over with impunity. No matter how intelligent a person is, there's an upper bound on the amount of information a single mind can process, store, and respond to. Above that limit, information may be stored in abstract terms, but it's processed differently from information related to that individual's personal experience or concerns. Dunbar's number is a theoretical cognitive limit on the number of stable social relationships humans can maintain at one time. According to Robin Dunbar, a British anthropologist, humans have the cognitive capacity to keep track of somewhere around 150 close personal connections. Beyond this limited circle, we start treating people less like individuals and more like objects, and groups of people beyond this limit are likely to splinter off into subgroups over time. If you've ever wondered why you don't write letters to your elementary school classmates, Dunbar's number is a decent hypothesis. You're too busy maintaining your ties to people who are in your immediate social circle. There's some controversy regarding the actual quantity of connections where cognitive scope limitation kicks in. The Bernard Killworth median, a competing estimate, is 231, but there's little doubt that such a limit exists. When a disaster strikes somewhere around the world that affects millions of people, we may feel bad, but we don't feel a million times what we would feel if that disaster directly affected a close friend or family member. The more remote the connection, the less an impact affects us individually. The tourists in Times Square aren't evil. They're just overwhelmed. Over 364,000 people pass through Times Square every day, and our minds simply aren't capable of handling that information at once. Abstractly, these people still realize that you're a human being, but there's so much going on in the area that it's difficult to treat you like one. The mind gets overwhelmed, so it starts simplifying reality to compensate. The same thing happens to executives of large companies. Rationally, they may be aware that they're responsible for hundreds of thousands of employees and millions of shareholders, but no matter how intelligent they are, their brains simply aren't capable of processing the magnitude of that reality. As a result, executives can hurt a lot of people without realizing it. The CEO of a large company may not particularly care if thousands of frontline workers are laid off. After all, they may not know any frontline workers personally. Whenever you see an executive making a boneheaded decision like dumping toxic waste into a river millions of people drink from, or downsizing thousands of jobs while handing out millions of dollars in bonuses, it's probably not because they're rotten to the core. As scary as it sounds, it's probably because they simply haven't thought too much about it. The scope and scale of what they're managing is too complex to handle, so their mind processes the decision abstractly instead of viscerally. Personalizing an issue is a way to hack this universal limitation. In the absence of brain upgrades, it's not possible to directly expand the scope of information our minds are capable of processing. In order to get around this limitation, it's useful to personalize decisions and issues by imagining they affect someone close to us. In the case of the boneheaded executive, they'd feel very different about their decision if their mother's water was polluted or their child's job was downsized. Instead of abstractly considering the issue, personalizing it makes it easier to feel the effects of the decision viscerally, which makes it easier to make better decisions. In the book Green to Gold, Daniel Etsy and Andrew Winston describe several ways of making it easier to internalize the results of large decisions. The newspaper rule and the grandchild rule are effective ways of personalizing the results of your decisions. The newspaper rule is a simulation of the following. Assume your decision was publicized on the front page of tomorrow's New York Times, and your parents and/or significant other read it. What would they think? Imagining the personal consequences of your decisions in this way is a much more accurate way to evaluate the impact of short-term decisions. The grandchild rule is a way of evaluating decisions with long-term consequences. Imagine that 30 or 40 years from now, your grandchild gives you feedback on the results of your decision. Will they laud you for your wisdom or reprimand you for your stupidity? Personalize the results of your decisions and actions, and you'll be far less likely to run afoul of the cognitive scope limitation. Association. Who cares which golf clubs Tiger Woods uses? Who cares which shoes Michael Jordan wears? Who cares which purse Paris Hilton is carrying? Your mind cares. Remember, your brain is taking in information all the time and is using it to create patterns that describe how the world works. Rationally, these things may not matter. You probably know that using the same golf clubs Tiger Woods uses won't magically correct your atrocious slice. When it comes time to buy golf clubs, however, your mind will be drawn to the clubs that make you feel good, and more likely than not, you'll find the clubs Tiger uses quite appealing. The human mind stores information contextually, including cues like environment and correlation. Because the brain is a pattern-matching machine, it's constantly trying to figure out what's associated with what. As a result, your mind effortlessly forms associations, even between things that aren't logically connected. For decades, the Coca-Cola Company has been associating Coke with a single emotion, happiness. Do a quick search for Coke commercials on YouTube. You won't find any images of layoffs or funerals. What you will find is a litany of happy moments. Adrian Brody cruising in his car, parades of whimsical creatures celebrating as a bottle of Coke exits a vending machine, and Charlie Brown winning the race for the runaway Coke bottle balloon in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Even holidays aren't immune. The company largely invented the modern image of Santa Claus, who just happened to be holding a bottle of Coke. It's possible to influence behavior by using associative cues, even associations that make no logical sense. Coca-Cola's advertisements don't convince soda consumers that Coke is better in some functional respect, now with 37% more sugar. But they do make people feel good whenever they think about Coke. When a customer is standing in the supermarket deciding which soft drink to buy, those feelings make a big difference in each customer's final choice. Consider beer commercials, which usually feature attractive women and confident men. Your rational mind knows that drinking a certain type of beer won't make you more attractive or confident, but correlation is powerful. Your brain will make the association anyway. As a result, beer ads influence behavior, even though no one takes the images they contain seriously. Presenting your prospects with positive associations can influence how they think about what you offer. Celebrity endorsements work because they tie into strong associations people already have with the endorsers, associations that rub off on the product or service being endorsed. Everyone knows James Bond is a fictional character, but when Daniel Craig is featured wearing a tuxedo in a watch advertisement, the Sophisticated International Spy Association is automatically transferred to the timepiece. Cultivate the right associations, and potential customers will want what you have even more. Absence blindness. Here's a curious fact about human beings. We have a really hard time realizing that something isn't there. When I worked in P&G's home care division, one of my first projects was testing the viability of a product that prevented things from getting dirty. You still had to clean, but it took more time for things to get dirty again, so the product saved the user significant time and effort. Once the product went into testing, however, it was apparent that the idea wasn't feasible. The product genuinely worked, but users didn't realize it. They had a hard time believing the product worked since they couldn't see anything happening. After the test phase was complete, the project was canceled. Absence blindness is a cognitive bias that prevents us from identifying what we can't observe. Our perceptual faculties evolve to detect objects that are present in the environment. It's far more difficult for people to notice or identify what's missing. Examples of absence blindness are everywhere. Here's a common example. Great management is boring and often unrewarding. The hallmark of an effective manager is anticipating likely issues and resolving them in advance, before they become an issue. Some of the best managers in the world look like they're not doing much, but everything gets done on time and under budget. The problem is, no one sees all of the bad things that the great manager prevents. Less skilled managers are actually more likely to be rewarded, since everyone can see them making things happen and moving heaven and earth to resolve issues, issues they may have created themselves via poor management. Make a note to remind yourself to handsomely reward the low-drama manager who quietly and effectively gets things done. It may not seem like their job is particularly difficult, but you'll miss them when they're gone. Absence blindness makes prevention grossly underappreciated. In the case of the product I was working on, people had a hard time believing that something they couldn't see working was actually effective. If you're trying to sell the absence or prevention of something, you're fighting an uphill battle, even if your product is great. Always state benefits in positive, immediate, concrete, and specific terms by focusing on things the user can directly experience. Absence blindness also makes it uncomfortable for people to do nothing when something bad happens, even if doing nothing is the best course of action. Often, the best course of action is to choose not to act, but that's often difficult for humans to accept emotionally. The economic boom and bust cycle most markets experience is partially a consequence of absence blindness. According to Ludwig von Mises in the book Human Action, economic bubbles are created when a government tries to encourage an economy to grow by artificially reducing interest rates, making it easier to borrow money. By making access to capital abnormally easy, this policy leads investors to speculate by paying abnormally high prices for assets they'd otherwise avoid, like tulip bulbs, dot-com companies with no revenue, and risky mortgage-backed securities. Eventually, the bubble pops when investors realize that the assets they've been speculating on aren't worth what they paid, leading to a sudden crash in the price of the overvalued asset. Because of loss aversion, people start freaking out and start clamoring for an immediate solution to the collapsing market. More often than not, the quote-unquote solution is to reduce interest rates even more to encourage the economy to start growing again, a self-reinforcing feedback loop that ultimately does nothing but exacerbate the issue by creating the conditions necessary for an even larger bubble to form down the road. To fix the issue, the best course of action is to stop artificially manipulating interest rates, which caused the issue in the first place. Unfortunately, absence blindness makes doing nothing psychologically uncomfortable. After all, we can't just sit here and do nothing while the world burns. As a result, people typically prefer the government to act, even if the action the government takes ultimately makes things worse. Experience makes it easier to avoid absence blindness. Experience is valuable primarily because the expert has a larger mental database of related patterns, and thus a higher chance of noticing an absence. By noticing violations of expected patterns, experienced people are more likely to get an odd feeling that things aren't quite right, which is often enough warning to find an issue before it becomes serious. In the book Sources of Power: How People Make Decisions, researcher Gary Klein tells the story of a team of firefighters putting out a fire on the first floor of a house. When water was sprayed at the base of the fire, the fire didn't respond as expected. It didn't diminish at all. The chief noticed and ordered everyone out. Something just didn't feel right. A few minutes later, the house collapsed. The fire had started in the basement, destroying the foundation. If the team had stayed inside, they would have died. That's the power and benefit of experience. The only reliable way I've found to overcome absence blindness is checklisting. By thinking in advance what you want something to look like and translating that into visible reminders you can refer to while making decisions, checklists can help you remember to look for the absence of qualities in the moment. We'll discuss creating checklists in great detail in Chapter 11. Contrast. If you walk into a department store to buy a business suit, you're likely to notice a few options that appear to be abnormally expensive. The store will very rarely sell these suits. That's not their purpose. Compared to a $3,000 suit, a $400 suit doesn't sound like a lot of money, even if the same suit could be purchased at another store for $200. The same principle applies to the order in which products are presented by the salesperson. After choosing a suit, you'll be directed to shirts, shoes, and accessories. Compared to a $400 suit, what's another $100 on shoes? $80 for a belt, $60 for a few shirts, $50 for a few ties, $40 for a set of cufflinks. Compared to the suit, the accessories seem inexpensive, so why not? Here's what Jordan Smart, one of my clients, reported, and I quote, "I went shopping last year on Black Friday looking to get some slightly more formal clothes. I went out with the intent of buying a set of shirts and two blazers. I thought for a while on buying ties to go with it, and decided that the one or two I had in my closet already would suffice. I went shopping at two stores. In the first, I picked out a set of shirts, and as I was leaving, the salesman asked if I needed ties to go with them. I politely told him no, and privately congratulated myself on sticking to my resolution. At the second store, I tried on a few blazers and decided to purchase them. Again, the salesman asked if I needed ties to go with my blazers. At that point, I very clearly remember thinking about the price of the blazers and thinking to myself, well, I'm spending this much money anyway, and proceeded to buy a set of ties. I didn't think anything of it until I learned about contrast. Looking back at the receipt, I realized I'd spent more on the ties than I had spent on the blazers. I realized I'd spent more on the ties than I had spent on the blazers." End quote. Our perceptions are influenced by information gathered from the surrounding environment. Is $10,000 a lot of money? It depends on your circumstances. If you have $10 in your bank account, $10,000 is an enormous sum. If you have $100 million, it's a rounding error. Our perceptual faculties are optimized to notice contrast, not compare what we perceive with things that aren't there, which is the root of absence blindness. Everything we notice and every decision we make is based on information gathered from the surrounding environment. That's why camouflage works. It reduces the contrast between an object and its surrounding environment, which makes it harder to notice. Contrast is often used to influence buying decisions. In the business world, contrast is often used as pricing camouflage. In the case of the $60 shirt, it may be possible to buy the exact same shirt at another retailer for $40, but the less expensive shirt isn't present in the store where the comparison is taking place. What is present is the $400 suit, which makes the $60 shirt look like a bargain. Compared with a $2,000 computer, a $300 extended warranty appears inexpensive, even though it increases the total purchase price by 15%. Compared with a $30,000 vehicle, spending an additional $1,000 for leather seats feels like a bargain. Compared with buying a $400,000 house, spending $20,000 to remodel the kitchen feels like no big deal. Framing is a way to control the perception of contrast. For example, I often use the phrase $149,000 less than a top-tier business program when marketing my online business course. Compared with buying a book, my course looks expensive. Compared with the cost of an MBA program, it's a bargain. Take advantage of contrast when presenting your offer, and you'll increase the odds that your potential customers will view your offer favorably. Scarcity. Because of conservation of energy, people have a natural tendency to decide to do things later unless there's a compelling reason to act immediately. As a business person, later is a big issue because later turns into never if the customer forgets about you. How can you encourage your customers to act immediately? Scarcity encourages people to make decisions quickly. Scarcity is one of the things that naturally overcomes our tendency to conserve. If you want something that's scarce, you can't afford to wait without the risk of losing what you want. Loss aversion ensures that this possibility feels bad enough to prompt us to take action now. As a result, adding a scarcity element to your offer is a great way to encourage people to take action. Scarcity makes people understand that they'll lose something valuable if they wait, making it more likely they'll choose to act immediately if they desire what is being offered. The more scarce the value, the more intense the desire. In 1996, Tickle Me Elmo was the hot toy of the Christmas season. Elmo was already a popular character, but limited quantities of the toy drove parents into a buying frenzy. Normally rational people started spending hundreds of dollars on eBay for the toy and mobbing retailers when new stock became available. Here are a few ways you can add an element of scarcity to your offer. Number one, limited quantities. Inform prospects that you're offering a limited number of units for sale. Number two, price increases. Inform prospects that the price will go up in the near future. Number three, price decreases. Inform prospects that a current discount will end in the near future. And number four, deadlines. Inform prospects that the offer is only good for a limited period of time. Scarcity that appears blatantly artificial can backfire. For example, putting an artificial limit on sales of ebooks, downloadable software, or electronic music files makes no sense. Everyone knows electronic files can be duplicated infinitely at essentially zero cost. So the scarcity feels manipulative, which makes people want to buy from you less. Price increases with deadlines, on the other hand, tend to work well. Raising the price after a certain number of orders or a certain amount of time is a reasonable policy and is less likely to come across to the customer as unreasonable and is less likely to come across to the customer as unreasonable or manipulative. Add an element of scarcity to your offer, and you'll encourage people to buy now instead of later. Novelty. At the height of World War II, Norman Mackworth took Royal Air Force radar operators away from their jobs for a special mission, staring at a clock for 2 hours at a time. Mackworth was a psychologist who specialized in studies of vigilance, the ability to maintain high levels of attention on a single object for long periods of time. Radar operators were natural test subjects. Their job mostly consisted of looking at blips on a radar screen in a dark room for hours on end. Most of the time, very little on the radar screen changed. When something abnormal appeared on the screen, however, it could be critically important. inbound enemy airplanes on a bombing mission. The radar operator's job was to be alert enough to notice anomalies immediately, but the task was extremely difficult. Boredom often led to mistakes that cost lives. To simulate this challenging environment, Mackworth created the Mackworth clock, a device designed to test how well people pay attention over time. The clock featured a second hand that worked like a normal clock, with a twist. It would randomly skip a second, ticking two notches instead of one. The test subject's job was to press a button every time they noticed the skip. Here's what Mackworth found. After 10 minutes of staring at the clock, the quality of the subject's attention went down dramatically. The maximum period of sustained attention, even highly motivated operators, who were given substantial bonuses for performance, were able to sustain was 30 minutes. Any longer, and they'd zone out. Novelty, the presence of new sensory data, is critical if you want to attract and maintain attention over a long period of time. One of the reasons people can focus on playing games or surfing the internet for hours at a time is novelty. Every new viral video, blog post, Facebook update, Twitter post, and news report re-engages our ability to pay attention. In the book Brain Rules, John Medina shares how he's able to keep the attention of his students effectively in classes that last more than an hour. He plans his class in modules that last no more than 10 minutes. Each module starts with a hook, an interesting story or anecdote, followed by a brief explanation of the key concept. Following this format ensures that his audience retains more information and doesn't zone out. That's the primary reason that this book is organized in short sections that take less than 10 minutes to listen to. Even the most remarkable object of attention gets boring over time. Human attention requires novelty to sustain itself. Continue to offer something new, and people will pay attention to what you have to offer.